This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today I'm pleased to say that my guest is Peter Gray, Professor of Modern Irish History and Director of the Institute of Irish Studies at Queen's University, Belfast. Today we're talking to Peter about his new book, William Sharman Crawford and Ulster Radicalism, just published by UCD Press. Peter, congratulations on the book and welcome to the show.
Hello, Crawford. Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, obviously, you and I are friends. We work together, have done. In fact, you gave me the job I have, so I do need to be very nice to you. But it's just great to be able to talk to you today about this book. It's a really big book. It's probably one of the biggest history books I've seen, what, quarter of a million words or probably slightly more? Yeah. So we'll talk about the size, the scale, the kind of project this is in just a second. But before we begin, maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Crawford. Well, I mean, I'm originally from Belfast in Northern Ireland, but I did a PhD way back in the late 80s, early 90s in Cambridge on the politics of the Great Irish Famine. And I suppose in many ways, ever since then, I've been working on different aspects of the history of British-Irish relations, the mid-19th century, the ramifications of the Great Famine, social policy. I've done a bit of work on the origins and the implementation of the poor law system in Ireland in the 1830s, 1840s. And I'm moving now into the kind of post-famine political environment of the 1850s and 1860s.
Now, you mentioned there post-famine context, but obviously this book is a bit of a saga, three or four generations of a span, and you begin telling the story of William Sharman Crawford by talking about his father. So why did you choose that as a framing device to tell the story of this individual?
Yeah, I mean, I started off the book, it was originally intended to be quite a short book. It's obviously, as you have pointed out, it ended up being rather more voluminous. But really, I started off deciding to tell the story of William Sharman Crawford himself, but it became very clear early into the project that I needed to go back into the kind of formative experience of his father, which is very much passed on to his son, and then also to take the narrative forward into the generation of William Sharman Crawford's children, especially James and Mabel Sharman Crawford, who are active really from the 1860s through to the end of the century. And then to kind of, I suppose, complete the arc of the rise and fall of a radical dynasty in Ulster through to his grandson's generation. So his grandson, in a sense, inverts the family's politics of radicalism and becomes quite a conservative Ulster Unionist, an MP under Carson, friend of Carson, and an officer in the Ulster Volunteer Force. And finds the types of insurgent radical agrarian politics that his grandfather had been so involved in leading, then kind of manifested against him in his political life in the early 20th century. So really, that's why the book has kind of expanded into this four-generational structure. It's been using, in a sense, the family history to follow the developments of Ulster radicalism as a phenomenon in both the pre-union period, from the early 1780s through to the 1798 rebellion, and then the revival of that phenomenon of Ulster Protestant radicalism, really, especially from the 1830s, 1840s onwards through the Gladstonian period, and then into its kind of, not quite its disappearance, but into its kind of sidelining, I suppose, to some extent by the turn of the 19th into the early 20th century.
That's great. So in some ways, as you mentioned, this is the story of a family. In a way, it's a story of a tradition. It's also the story of a community. All of these themes weave together, I think, really insightfully through this text. Let's talk about William Sharman Crawford's father, William Sharman. The book begins by focusing our attention on him and the context of a phenomenon known as volunteering in the 18th century. Why is William Sharman significant? And also, maybe you could tell us why he has a different name than his son.
Yeah, so my central figure is obviously William Sharman Crawford. Now, he starts off as William Sharman Jr. He's born in 1780 to William and Arminella Sharman. He changes his name in 1827 as a consequence of the inheritance of his father-in-law's estates in County Down. His father-in-law is John Crawford. He had married in 1805 Mabel Crawford, John's daughter, and he inherits John's estates in 1827. And that's quite a common, you know, Victorian practice to add on the name of the benefactor or the person you're inheriting land from. So that's why the name change takes place. So William Sharman himself starts off really from quite a conventional Anglican Protestant descendancy, I suppose we could say, background. He's a small landowner in County Antrim, County Down, County Meath. But he's heavily influenced by the impact of the ideas and then the kind of popular excitement around first the American Revolution in the late 1770s, early 1780s, and then the French Revolution of 1789. Now, he himself is not a revolutionary, but he believes that the ideas of popular mobilization, the ideas of the necessity of political representation, he's not quite a full Democrat, but he does believe in the great expansion of the franchise and the inclusion of the popular interest in political decision making. So he's very much influenced by those ideas coming out of America and coming out of France, as indeed many other people throughout Ireland, but especially in the Northeast are in the 1780s. The volunteer movement starts off really as a kind of volunteer militia to defend Ireland against invasion during the war, especially against potential French invasion in 1778, but very rapidly morphs into a political organization demanding greater autonomy for Ireland. And then from 1783 onwards, as the movement kind of splits into different factions, from 1783 onwards, the Northern Volunteers very much move towards the advocacy of parliamentary reform and Catholic emancipation, the inclusion of the obviously majority Catholic population on the island within the political nation and within these aspirations towards representation of the people.
So William Sharman has this quite significant career as a political thinker, doesn't he, within this tradition of Ulster radicalism. His son is born, and what influence do those ideas have on his son, the man who becomes William Sharman Crawford?
Yeah, so William Sharman, the elder, is a colonel in the volunteer movement. He's elected an MP for the borough of Lisburn in a kind of rebellion against landowners' control of the Lisburn borough. He chairs a number of important political conventions, the Dungannon Conventions of 1783 and 1793, and he presides over a parade to celebrate the fall of the Bastille, or to commemorate it in Belfast in 1791. So his son, as a child, is brought along to all these events in the late 1780s, early 1790s. He writes in a personal memoir he authors in 1844 about his childhood memory of his father as the volunteer leader, as the centre of this movement. And the young William is educated at home by his parents in Moira Castle, which is where he is born and grows up. His father dies in 1803, and William inherits his lands and his estates. By that time, of course, you know, that first surge of radicalism has dissipated. The more ultra radicals have moved into a more revolutionary organization, the United Irishmen, after 1791, and their rebellion, which the elder William doesn't participate in 1798, has ended in a kind of catastrophic explosion of violence, repression, bloodshed, And I think that's also a formative moment for the younger William. He's 18 years old when that failed rebellion takes place in the countryside around him in County Down. He witnesses the aftermath of that and in a sense commits himself to the revival of his father's political ideas, but in a non-violent mode, just in a parallel way to the great Catholic leader Daniel O'Connell, also witnesses 1798 and commits himself also to non-violent direct action as a political principle in the wake of 1798. So I think in that way the two men have parallel experiences.
We'll talk about Daniel O'Connell in a few moments, Peter, but for now, could you tell us a little bit about how the man who becomes William Sharman Crawford begins his own political career?
Yeah, so there's a kind of delay. It's not really until the late 1820s that he becomes politically active, in some ways after he inherits his father-in-law John Crawford's estates in 1827 and moves his family, which is not quite large, he's got 10, 11 children by this point, to Crawfordsburn in North Down. And once he's established there in 1827, he starts to get involved in county politics and becomes involved in the Catholic Emancipation Campaign. There is a kind of parallel liberal Protestant participation in the demands for Catholic emancipation, which are led as a kind of mass movement by Daniel O'Connell in the 1820s. And Sharman Crawford is speaking on platforms in 1828, 1829, supporting O'Connell's campaign, and is very much influenced by the example that O'Connell sets at that time. So that starts to draw him into active politics. He's a kind of political agent for the Liberal candidate in the County Down election of 1830. And then he first stands himself as a candidate for County Down in 1831 as a radical, self-described radical, supporter of the Whig government's Parliamentary Reform Bill, but demanding more than that, demanding that there should also be an additional increase of the franchise. There should be the secret ballot, and that there should be other reforms alongside the extension of the franchise. He's defeated in that election in 1831, although he makes his name as a radical candidate. He gets significant degrees of popular support, and there's a mobilisation of both the landed interest, the conservative landed interest, and the Orange Order for the first time against him in that election in 1831. So that's how he enters into politics, through the Catholic Emancipation Campaign and then into the politics of County Down. And then what we see really from that point onwards is the expansion of his political engagement in a series of like concentric rings from County Down into the industrial centre of Belfast, which he stands as a candidate for in 1832, then on into Irish national politics by 1833, 1834, and then onto the kind of, if you like, British political stage by the mid to late 1830s.
And the burden of the book traces that expansion of influence and argument, doesn't it? What kind of sources did you use to construct or reconstruct his ideas, Peter?
So there is a family archive in the Public Record Office here in Belfast. It's good for certain periods. There's a particularly interesting series of correspondence between him and his eldest son, John, when his son is travelling in North America in the mid-1830s. There are other periods in which correspondence tends to kind of disappear to a minimum. So what I did is I supplemented that with newspaper sources, principally. Sharman Crawford writes a number of pamphlets, about six or seven pamphlets on different subjects, but he's constantly writing public letters to the newspapers, two or three a week throughout his political life from the early 1830s to the start of the 1860s. So he lives his political life in public, engages constantly in debates, and you can kind of reconstruct his political thoughts and his political life through a combination of the private papers and these public statements.
It's an interesting thing to do to balance the public and private, isn't it? Because in some ways, he's the representative of a minority class for whom the state has been designed. You know, he's the beneficiary of state organization, and yet in a way, he's campaigning against it. Now, how important was his Church of Ireland identity to him, and did that begin to change over time?
Yes. So he, like his father, is born an Anglican and remains an Anglican for most of his life. But by the mid-1830s has come to adopt a political stance on the church and on church issues, which is very much at variance with not only with the Church of Ireland's position, the Church of England's position, but also with the majority of the landed class from which he came. He's a strong supporter of the abolition of the tithes, the tax levied on land on the peasant farmers to pay for the costs of the Church of Ireland. He demands its total abolition. By the mid-1830s, he's calling for the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland and for complete freedom of religion. So the removal of any privileges from the church. Ultimately, by the mid-1850s, this leads him into a process of conversion from Anglicanism to Unitarianism. And there's a lot of documents generated towards the end of his life in which he kind of painstakingly explains this spiritual journey that he takes from the church into the non-subscribing Presbyterian or Unitarian congregation in North Down.
Now, Peter, do you think, having reviewed his life, do you think his religious ideas are driving his politics or vice versa? Or is there some other kind of relationship between the two?
I think they're part of a wider development of political radicalism in his thinking. He's inheriting a lot from his father. He's inheriting, if you like, the Enlightenment ideals of the late 18th century from his father, and that kind of non-revolutionary strand of radical reformism that the Volunteers had embodied. But he's combining that and his own specific contribution to radicalism is the development of, if you like, an agrarian consciousness. He inherits his father's estates, but decides to run them really on a kind of cooperative basis with his own tenants, the farmers on his own estate. He decides not to pursue the maximization of rent, as most landowners do. In a sense, imposes a series of voluntary constraints on his own powers, fully recognizes the Ulster custom on his estates, which is the tradition of recognizing that the farmer has a financial interest in their farms, which must be recognized and compensated if the farmer should be evicted or should leave. So he fully recognizes that, and then starts by the mid-1830s to demand that this be turned into legislation, that this should be imposed on the other landowners through law. And as an MP from 1835, is constantly introducing bills into Parliament to seek to legislate for what's known as tenant right. So this agrarianism puts him into conflict with his fellow landlords, the ascendancy class, the dominant, powerful class in the Irish countryside, not just on religious grounds in terms of his rejection of the supremacy of the Church of Ireland and the establishment of the Church of Ireland, but now also on social and economic grounds. He becomes in many ways a pariah amongst his own class, a class traitor. That term isn't quite used, but something very similar to it is used by landlords as early as 1831 against him. So he's very much seen as, and he's not unique in this. I mean, there are other figures in Irish history at the same time who are kind of abandoning their class identity. William Smith O'Brien, the leader of the Young Irelanders in 1848, is in this category. And we can see, you know, Charles Stuart Parnell later on in the 1870s and 1880s also kind of moving in this direction away from the inherited privilege of a landed background towards adopting a kind of popular agrarianism. In the case of Parnell, taking it further towards nationalism as well.
So the 1830s, then, Sharman Crawford is associated with Daniel O'Connell. By the mid-1830s, he's been set up as an English MP, and yet his preoccupations are always Irish, aren't they? So how does this work in terms of political development?
So the relationship with O'Connell is an interesting one. He's an admirer of O'Connell, you know, because he had been drawn into politics very much in support of the Catholic Emancipation Campaign. By 1833, Sharman Crawford is convinced that some form of Irish self-government is essential, that there should be some form of what would later be described as home rule, and publishes a couple of pamphlets advocating that, and is welcomed by O'Connell into the repeal movement Department, as it's called at the time. And it's O'Connell who arranges for him to find a seat for Dundalk in County Louth in 1835. But that relationship soured. It breaks down quite quickly for a number of reasons. First of all, O'Connell's political leadership style is quite authoritarian. Sharma Crawford and a number of other people within the movement are always pushing back against that and coming into friction and conflict with O'Connell. But there are also substantive issues of difference as well. O'Connell is a political radical, a nationalist, but socially quite conservative, quite paternalistic in his social thought. Sharma Crawford is pushing for the total abolition of tithes. O'Connell is prepared to make compromises on that. Sharma Crawford demands that there should be a generous, inclusive, and lenient poor law for Ireland, that there should be an effective and non-pauperizing welfare system for the country. O'Connell is opposed to that. And fundamentally, Sharma Crawford believes that the constitutional question needs to be resolved through what becomes known as federalism. That is, that there should be Irish self-government, but as a kind of devolved parliament with local powers within a political structure in which Westminster remains sovereign. He believes that's the only way it's going to be able to be enacted. And also that's the only way that kind of the economic integrity of the British-Irish kind of units will be retained if Westminster retains control over economic policy. That puts him into conflict with O'Connell. For all of those reasons, the relationship breaks down and Sharma Crawford is forced out of his seat for Dundalk in 1837. And there's an extremely bitter aftermath to that. They're constantly writing public letters against each other in the press in the later 1830s and denouncing each other. At one point, O'Connell calls Sharma Crawford an Anglo-Saxon rat. it becomes quite nasty, and it forces Sharma Crawford then to think about a wider and quite different political reorientation, to seek new allies and not to depend on O'Connell and nationalism to take forward his reforming agenda by the late 1830s.
And that English stage of his career corresponds to the timing of the famine, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the English stage of his career begins really by 1837-38, when he starts to travel to the north of England, in particular, well, London, and then to the north of England, to build alliances with British democratic radicals. And he becomes very friendly with William Lovett, who is the leader of the London Working Men's Association, and the author of a tract in 1838 called The People's Charter. Sharma Crawford signs as one of the signatories of the People's Charter drawn up by Lovett, which is in some ways the foundation document for the British democratic reformist movement, the foundation document for the Chartist movement. By 1841, Sharma Crawford has been invited to stand as a candidate for an English industrial constituency, Rochdale, in the north of England, by the local Chartists, but also the local liberal radicals, John Bright, who becomes very important in British politics afterwards. He's elected for Rochdale in 1841 and signs up to seeking to implement in the British Parliament the demands of the Chartists, although he hopes that he can build a kind of broader reformist alliance with middle-class radicals, which would create certain friction between him and some of the other Chartist leaders. So that's the position he's in by the early 1840s, by the time the economic crisis of the famine hits Ireland in 1845. He's the MP for Rochdale from 1841 to 1852 and is a voice in Parliament, very much a left voice in Parliament, against the political establishment, against the government, an advocate of working class demands like the reduction in the hours of work, the reform of the English poor law, and further democratic reforms.
So it's a four-generation saga. What happens to his legacy after his death?
Yeah, so during the famine itself, Sharma Crawford, I think his social thought moves leftwards as well. He becomes a kind of massive critic of his own class, the landlords, denounces them as the agents of extermination, demands what become known as the three Fs That is a fixity of tenure, that tenants should not be evicted, since he curbs on evictions. Fair rents, that rents of land should be set judicially by arbitration, and freedom of sale, which is the defence of the tenant rights custom. And all of these should be extended across the whole island as a solution to the economic crisis. And this leads him into participation in the Tenant League movement, which is emerging during the famine itself, in really from 1847 onwards, becomes a national movement in 1850, in which he is involved. And he stands as a candidate, essentially a Tenant League candidate for County Down, returning to his Irish roots in 1852, on this platform of the necessity of really quite extensive land reform. And this leads to a kind of massive confrontation with the landed establishment. Again, as you would anticipate, he loses that election, but remains active in radical politics, within the tenant movement and also within the democratic movements right the way through until his death in 1861. So in some ways, it's this later stage, this formative period of being central to the establishment of a tradition of non-violent mobilization to bring about land reform. That is his principal legacy throughout the century. That movement kind of starts to collapse by the mid-1850s for various reasons. But it's revived, obviously, with the Land League movement in 1879, led by Michael Davitt and Charles Stewart Parnell. So in some ways, you know, that defining, that kind of profoundly successful later land agitation of the Land League has its origins and its roots in the Tenant League movement of the late 1840s and early 1850s. And as the British government finally moves in 1870 and then 1881 and subsequently to respond to demands for land reform in Ireland, it often, Gladstone, for example, the Prime Minister, often refers back to Sherman Crawford as having essentially established these ideas within the political agenda back in the 1830s and 1840s, and it's only now, later on, a generation later, that they're being implemented. So there is very much a memory, particularly in the north, that he embodied a tradition of land agitation that needs to be revived and to be sustained, and also a memory in the British political culture that he was a generation ahead of his time, putting forward the demands for reform that finally are acknowledged and implemented from the 1870s onwards.
Great. And do his family remain advocates of his views?
Yeah, so certainly his children do, especially his son James, who stands as a Liberal candidate, a supporter of Gladstone in 1874, and is elected for County Down. Now, by that time, there is a secret ballot brought in 1872. So his father had failed twice to be elected in conditions in which landlords very much used their power to control the electorate. In 1874, his son James is elected as a Liberal and pushes for further land reform through until his death in 1878. His daughter Mabel, of course, who can't stand because of the restrictions on women's political activity, pushes back against those. She very much believes that her father's land reform campaign was correct, and she runs a small estate herself on cooperative grounds, you know, citing him as her inspiration. She becomes a significant figure in the Irish women's suffrage movement by the 1870s, 1880s. And in the great kind of split within Irish liberalism in 1886, she opts to support Gladstone, support his embrace of home rule for Ireland, and cites her father's advocacy of federalism as the model for that. So she argues he had been a proto home ruler, and she is maintaining his political tradition by continuing to support Gladstone at a time when one of her other brothers, Arthur, who by that point owns the Crawfordsburn estate, is committing himself against home rule. He becomes a Liberal Unionist.
Well, Peter, it's a fascinating book. It's a massive story. It's so extensive in every chapter's range. What was it about writing this project that most excited you?
Yeah, well, I first came across William Sherman Crawford a long time ago when I was working on the politics of the Great Famine and looking for ways in which alternative responses had been articulated right at the centre of politics. He had been a voice in the British Parliament and through his publications demanding a more humane, a more constructive, a more egalitarian response to the famine. He had not been successful, obviously, in persuading the government or the political establishment of those points back during the crisis, but had stood out, I think, as a moral voice of criticism against the abandonment of the Irish people to their fate. So I'd always, you know, been struck by that. I kind of always planned to come back and look at him again. And there had been no biography of him. Significant figure in the 19th century, but largely forgotten in the 20th century. So I felt that his story needed to be told. It was an important one, and that it was a way of telling other stories, you know, telling stories about radicalism and the revival of radicalism within Protestant society in the north of Ireland in the 19th century as well. So I hope the book is successful in bringing those points across, bringing him back into public attention and bringing the movements that he was so heavily involved with back into discussion again.
Well, I think you've certainly put him on the map. If he was ever off it, he's definitely on it now. So, Peter, thank you so much for writing this. It's a big book. It's really, really valuable. And I hope everyone who's listening decides to pick up a copy and read it. Peter, we've taken up a lot of your time today, but before we wind up, could you tell us what you're working on next?
Yeah, so... There isn't a proper study, academic study of the Tenant League organization at all. So I'm kind of working on that at the moment, trying to look at it as a grassroots movement as well as what I've been doing so far, looking at its leadership and the dynamics of its leadership. And I'm interested in it as a kind of international, transnational movement as well. One of its leaders, Charles Gavan Duffy, emigrates to Melbourne in Victoria, Australia, in 1855, and I'm interested in the way in which he and which other Irish emigrants to Victoria seek to implement the ideas of the Tenant League of land reform in Ireland in the very different context of Australia in the 1850s, 1860s, and 70s. So this is, I think, an important Irish movement, but it also has these transnational resonances as well, and I'm trying to follow those up and explore those as well at the moment.
That's brilliant. Look forward to hearing more about that in due course. Well, Peter, it's been great to speak to you today. Thank you for writing this book, William Sherman Crawford and Ulster Radicalism by Peter Gray, published by UCD Press just a few months ago. Really impressive piece of work. And it's been great to speak to you about it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Crawford.
And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on the New Books Network podcast.